Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Film Pigs podcast for February 2022. We're doing a bacon episode, and it's, I don't know, it's kind of sad in a certain way because we're dedicating this particular bacon episode to a movie that Skelton and I, Steve Skelton, who's here. Hi, Steve.
Yeah.
I'm Todd Anderson, by the way. And we were supposed to go with Steve Falk as well. We were supposed to do a Film Pigs Moonfall screening. That was...
Yeah, we were all pretty excited about it.
Yeah, we got super excited about it, like, weeks before it opened. And then on opening weekend, Steve Falk had to go to New York for work. So we were like, no, we'll put it off. And then we put it, and then the next weekend, I can't remember what happened. Something happened.
Some other scheduling.
Yeah, he had to do some other works in other places. So we put it off for one more weekend. And then, we went to see it yesterday, at the time of this recording yesterday. And and Steve's car broke down, and he couldn't find a babysitter. So it all fell apart, but we had to go, Steve Skelton. Because
yeah. Well, no, like Moonfall waits for no one.
Well, it wasn't waiting much longer in the theaters for us to see it.
Yeah, I guess that was really the reason.
As I learned, because, you know, it opened a lot wider than it was playing this past weekend. I guess a lot of multiplexes decided on extra screens for Uncharted. Because Moonfall was not making enough money, but
somehow Uncharted is making a lot of money.
I guess, is it?
I think it's had a pretty good opening weekend.
Yeah, oh, good for Uncharted.
Yeah, congratulations.
I'm gonna wait. I'm gonna wait for cable on that one. But so Moonfall, we did see it. We squeezed it in before it disappeared. Ultimately, Skelton, I mean, like, you're moaning already. Like, in the end, what was it for you? I mean, what happened?
I've been thinking about this a little too much today, in preparation for this bacon episode. And, you know, one of the things, like, okay, it's a disappointing movie. It's pretty boring, because I think it kind of just goes through the bullet points of a disaster movie. So there's no real big surprises or interesting twists on the genre, the disaster movie genre. But and the script is weirdly bland, and kind of just talks at you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And when in a disaster movie, it feels like there should just be more disaster spectacle and less talking, but there's just a lot of talking. Or maybe there wasn't that much talking, but the talking was so kind of bland that it felt like there was a lot. It felt like there were some scenes where there was like a character would deliver a monologue about themselves, and then the next character would immediately follow that with a monologue about themselves. And it was just like really, it just felt like this. I don't know. The script felt very, very flat. And what I will say is, but I think I hit on what really was bugging me about a Moonfall, and it's not just a Moonfall thing. But what I will say in defense of Moonfall is what I said when we left the theater, that there is a lot more moonfalling in Moonfall than there were geostorms in Geostorm.
That's true.
So they actually, you know, Emmerich, you know, and writers, they set up this bit where, you know, the moon's in a decaying orbit, essentially, and so it keeps coming around to cause havoc in its orbit. And so they use that mechanism so they can wreck a lot of stuff. I don't think they used it enough.
Yeah.
But that at least setup is there. But here's the thing that jumped into my head a little earlier today about what really kind of like made it the movie fall flat for me, which is it's a tendency of this kind of this more modern take on the disaster movie, as opposed to like, you know, a Towering Inferno or an Earthquake or, you know, any of the, I guess, airports, mm-hmm. comma 70 somethings. And it's like, it's the same problem Geostorm had, but it's a different problem that, like, previous Emmerich, I mean, Independence Day's kind, that's not really more of an alien invasion. Not really, I wouldn't necessarily classify that as a disaster movie. But, like, Day After Tomorrow didn't, have this problem. Day After Tomorrow was like, but that was that an Emmerich or was that?
Yeah, that was Emmerich.
Okay. It didn't have this, it was more old school disaster versus the new school disaster, which is, and the key difference is in the new school disaster, the characters are actively trying to stop the disaster and find a way to actually stop the disaster versus old school disaster movies, which is it's how the characters survive this inevitable disaster that is way too big for them. Mm-hmm. And it's a key difference. And that's why I think these modern disaster movies aren't as fun or as interesting. Like Geostorm was the same thing. It was like, well, the big bad of the movie gets stopped.
Yeah.
And the characters never have to actually live through a Geostorm and deal with the world in the aftermath of it in the way that, like, the Towering Inferno, it's like they don't stop the fire. Poseidon Adventure, they don't stop the boat from turning over.
Even actually, when you consider Emmerich's last disaster movie, and this one skirts as not being a disaster movie at a certain point because it really is a space invasion movie again, in a lot of ways. Well, yeah, that's what it is. It's a space movie, a space alien movie, disaster movie. So Independence Day kind of was a disaster movie, but mixed.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't necessarily count it as a full-on disaster movie. It's but
this one almost like is sort of more in that territory than Emmerich's. I think Emmerich's last one that he actually did was 2012.
I think so.
And that's the old school kind of disaster that you're talking about, because it's just a family running away from disasters trying to.
Yeah, and they have no hope of stopping it. The only hope they have is surviving it.
Yeah, and escaping it in a way.
Yeah.
I agree. Although I would. Have you seen Greenland?
Yeah. I like Greenland.
So yeah, that one is like what you're talking about, which is interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
It's another Gerard Butler disaster movie.
No, because it's a character. Yeah, but it's a character-driven. You know, it's the character surviving this thing that's way bigger than them. Versus, like, you know, it's the absurdity of being able to stop the moon crashing into the Earth. Like, is because in order to set that up, you have to establish these ludicrous plot points that the movie does, and it's like, hey, spoiler alert, everybody, but, you know, I'm spoiling Moonfall, so who cares? You know, so the whole gimmick of Moonfall is the moon's not actually the moon, it's this hollow alien satellite that, you know, so there's the gimmick set up where, well, we could stop it from falling because it's got an engine.
Was this
we just have to turn it around.
I feel like this movie was made, like, conceptually made out of QAnon theories.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, like, very conspiracy theory, but the harmless kind of conspiracy theory, like the Ancient Aliens kind of conspiracy theory stuff, where it's like, yeah, fine, you know, it's not, you know, it's the super fringy stuff, but it's still kind of like, you know, they cram every little bit of kind of sci-fi trope into this moon machine that, you know, that then the good guys have to fly through all this debris to get to, and then there's a nanobot swarm that they have to fight, and then an AI, friendly AI that helps them, and, you know, and that it was so unimaginative, like that whole setup.
But like, also
it was a pastiche of a bunch of other, like, halfway thought through sci-fi concepts.
It was like convoluted cliche. That's what it was.
And honestly, and that's the kind of stuff, like, I can forgive that easily if the movie's fun, right? If there's these great, amazing set pieces with fun characters, you know, having interesting and fun and entertaining reactions to the stuff that's going on around them. But everyone was so dull in this movie. No one was seemed to be very concerned about anything that was happening around them.
No, they didn't. And you had mentioned after the movie yesterday that it felt like so many of the performances felt like, oh, I have to say these words now.
It just seemed like
everybody was in pain. And the dialogue really is bad. There was that one part where, you know, the guy decides to pull his key out of the nuclear device because his ex-wife, played by Halle Berry, can save them, and they shouldn't.
Right,
because
she's in the moon machine.
What? Because that never happens in movies. So they're about to, and he pulls his key out, and the other guy says, "If you're wrong, God help you." And his response is, "God help us all." And it's not even like he didn't even say, "If I'm wrong, God help us all," or add something. He just said it was almost like they didn't finish the cliche. Completely.
Yeah, it's all felt like placeholder dialogue. So I'd be really curious and interested to know from kind of the writing side of it, like how this script came together and the decision making, because, you know, whatever was going on with that script, it just was so flat for me that I just was like, I should be having fun when the moon comes around and starts wrecking stuff, but I'm not, because everything's been so dull up to this point with all the characters. Like, and none of the characters were particularly interesting or fun or, you know, like,
and
like
the
most colorful,
the colors,
most
of
colorful
the
character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most colorful character was the conspiracy theory guy, who I can't remember the actor, who played him, who was doing everything he could possibly do, I think, as an actor, to make a character that is made up of nothing but cliches interesting.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause again, yeah, I can't fault any acting in this movie, because I think every single actor had an impossible job with the script. Just gave them nothing to work with.
The literal colors of the movie, the way it looked, was very drab and muted. And it was odd. And when I think about it in Roland Emmerich's oeuvre, I think about Independence Day Resurgence. And this movie feels closer to that than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Even aesthetically, it was like, it had that same kind of general sci-fi sheen over it, but it didn't have any kind of particular personality, it felt like.
Yeah.
It just felt like generic sci-fi.
Yeah. And the same thing with the like bad dialogue and the performances all felt like, you know, contractual obligations. And also just like, it just didn't look good in Insurgents. It was just kind of drab looking. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, it's something like Independence Day has plenty of stuff that pops, you know, you got these bright LA mornings with Will Smith and his family and all that. And then when the explosions happen, they're like really bright. It almost feels like you can feel the light reflecting, you know, on your face as you're watching it. But this movie didn't have that. Like, and Independence Day Resurgence didn't have that. It just felt the whole thing felt muted visually to me.
Yeah, it was weird. It's just, yeah, very, very muted, very kind of generic. And yeah, I can't, like, I saw this movie yesterday and I'm trying to think, is there any kind of like image that sticks in my head from this movie, like an Independence Day, you know, like the White House being, you know, zapped by the beam, you know, the downtown LA, that whole sequence being zapped by the beam and, you know, Will Smith and Goldblum walking through the desert after the crash with the cigars. Like, there's not, I can't think of an image from Moonfall that sticks with me like that.
I remember things, but I remember them, I think, for the wrong reasons, I guess. But one of the things I remember is when the space shuttle was taken off, you know, and there was a gravity wave. And, you know, they set up these nerdy characters who talk to the main nerdy guy. And, you know, and they're like sweet and they're dedicated and all that. But then the wave comes, the shuttle's taken off.
They just get wiped.
They jump on a helicopter, unceremoniously wiped out
by the helicopter, like an afterthought.
Yeah, and I was like,
and no one ever says anything about
it. No, it's just, okay, they're gone now.
Yeah, that's it. All right.
I mean, at least
that's a wrap on those guys.
The other thing that made me laugh was Michael, and sticks in my head, is Michael Pena's final moments in the film.
When he gives his oxygen away, sacrifices.
There's a lot of Armageddon sacrifices in this movie. This is one of them, but it's just sort of funny because, like we're saying, it so much of the acting felt like, okay, I have to do this now, versus I'm engaged with this.
Well, but it also felt like a total unnecessary sacrifice because, literally, a minute later, they say the oxygen's coming back.
I know.
And so there's no way, they were just trying to get to this shelter, and so the one tank is out, but, you know, scuba divers buddy breathe on a tank, a single tank. So, he could have. Yeah. It seemed like they were so close to where everybody else was. It didn't make any sense.
They clearly wanted.
But also the timeline of the whole movie didn't make any sense because it was like, hey, the moon's falling. Uh-oh. We got to get a space shuttle out of mothball, the Endeavor out of the frickin' museum in LA out of the mothballs and launch it. And they do that in a day, which doesn't make any sense because first off, it's like, I'm like, okay, it's not like the Endeavor at the museum in Los Angeles is got like all its insides and engines. Like you could just gas it up and turn it on. Like all that stuff was dismantled from the interior. Because you don't want a live rocket engine in a museum.
That's true. But all of this.
Even just saying, okay, fine, I'll give them that bit because this is a B movie setup. So who cares? But then even beyond that, it's like they say, oh, we got to get the space shuttle out of the museum, and then suddenly the external fuel tank and the two solid rocket boosters are just materialized. Like they didn't even talk about needing to get them at all, and they were like, those were there, but in a okay. But the space shuttle we had to go get. So much was glossed over. It felt like I was a little insulted by that. My intelligence, just because it was like it felt like the filmmakers were like, should we try and explain this in a way that makes any amount of sense whatsoever? Nah.
I agree, and it's so dumb, but all of this dumbness would have been easy to forgive.
If it had had some quirkiness to it.
Any sense of fun at all. You know, because you look at Independence Day in 2012, and you got lead performances that are fun, you know? I mean, you got Woody Harrelson acting crazy in 2012 and John Cusack driving an RV away from a volcano or whatever. I mean, it's ridiculous and unbelievable, but it keeps going and it has that, you know, old-timey serial episodic from action sequence to action sequence that works. And this one just didn't have it. And you're right. So the script got really bogged down, especially in its sentimentality. We're talking about all the there were so many monologues before people died, you know, or sacrificed themselves or whatever. And I know they were trying to, you know, pull at our heartstrings and get us emotionally involved. But that was the wrong choice with the running time. Just should have been more action. Yeah, and I mean, and we're up in the space shuttle so much and not down, because they do have the families of the people up in the space shuttle are running away from the disaster.
Yeah,
but it's like that part of the movie is really a subplot. It's like a very small B subplot to the A of
Again, going kind of against the classic disaster movie framework, it's really just like a couple of tracks of stories as opposed to like half a dozen.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, you know, skip around all over the place.
Which would have made more sense if they had done it more Earthquake style or Towering Inferno style. There would have been more characters to just kind of keep us going with it. But because it just was Halle Berry and Patrick Wilson are up in space with a chubby English guy fighting nanobots. And then every now and then you check down on Earth so you can see a disaster. But he also didn't really pick very interesting locales for the disasters. You know, you didn't get your usual, you know, whatever classic city getting wrecked.
Well, you got New York.
Yeah, but it was sort of that was like an aftermath, really, thing. I mean, there was
Well, no, they had the one sequence where the moon passed like straight over the New York skyline. And then you were like, for half a second, you were like, I think they probably had a creative meeting about whether or not they were going to destroy the Freedom Tower the New York skyline. And then went, nah, we're not going to do that. We'll just let the moon pass.
Right. But we weren't hanging out with too many characters in New York when that happened.
No, again, it was like that. Yeah, because that's the other thing is it's like it's not, you know, it passed by New York and you're like, okay, but I don't care because we've never seen any character in this movie in New York. So it's just, you know, more computer destruction.
It was very deep impact in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like every now and then you'd see, and the core was like that too. Every now and then you'd see some major landmark in some big thriving metropolis get wrecked, but you weren't hanging out with any characters.
Just for the sake of seeing that landmark. But yeah, but again, like in Moonfall, we didn't really get the only landmark I can think of is the New York skyline.
Yeah, that's it.
In that one sequence, but the other stuff was like, so what were the other cities? I mean, I think LA was one maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe because it was coastal, because they were doing all the tsunami stuff.
Right.
So I'm assuming that was SoCal. I can't even remember.
I don't remember.
Either. I'm pretty sure it was, that's where Patrick Wilson was running around in the hotel room, in the hotel sequence.
Oh, right. Yes. Flooded, yeah. Right? Yeah. I think that was, or it could have been, I don't know where the hell it was. Could have been.
It was either like SoCal or Florida.
Yeah. I'm not sure. It's one of those places. I don't know.
But I don't remember because it wasn't that made that important. So like, why do you think the whole kind of the production ended up this way with this kind of, you know, direction that Emmerich went in versus kind of his older school disaster invasion movies that are more fun? Cause you know, he's made fun, big, crazy disaster movies before.
Yeah.
That's why I was looking forward to this. Cause I was like, you know, okay, he's going to do another one. That's awesome. Let's do it.
Yeah, and obviously he could sell it and make it happen. What was his last movie? It was Midway, another Patrick Stewart, not Patrick Stewart, Patrick Wilson picture. Midway, you know, the remake of Midway.
Midway?
Yeah.
I can't even remember if I saw that.
You know, it's fine. You know, it's not as bad as Pearl Harbor, you know, but it's not Dunkirk either, you know. You know what I mean? It's closer
to the Nick Cage Indianapolis movie than Dunkirk.
No, because it looks better. The USS Indianapolis movie with Nick Cage just looks so bad because the effects are so shitty. Midway's got, you know, the decent Roland Emmerich computer effects. And the movie itself, I thought, was real old school, like as far as a war movie is concerned. I don't know how good a choice that is, you know, but it, it, it was fun in a way, I guess, you know, for a war movie, a little bit more rah-rah us sort of thing, which you don't get that much anymore, which is dumb, but, you know, I liked it enough.
So he's kind of echoing kind of the more jingoistic kind of like 50s, 60s World War II pictures.
Yeah, exactly. And then I guess that didn't do well. So he had to return to, you know, his what's made him giant, which is his disaster stuff. So he obviously, I think a lot of this is Roland Emmerich wants to keep working, wants to stay relevant, but it just kind of seems like he was passionless about the story itself.
Well, do you think it was that, or that it was because, you know, because of the position he's in where, you know, the last, you know, a couple of movies haven't been huge successes, but they've been expensive. So if he wants to do another expensive movie, he's got, there's more, you know, concessions he has to make to whoever's investing. Cause it looked like it was like from the opening credits, it looked like it was kind of a half Hollywood, half Chinese production.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely was. That's as good a theory as any that he.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering if a lot of the choices that kind of like flattened out.
Yeah.
Kind of our perception of it were from the position of like, oh, this is how, you know, this is what needs to be done to make it, you know, a more appealing globally.
Do you think
in theory, in theory, whether that's true or not, that but that may be like, you know, from, you know, the various investment partners, you know, who are going to have a greater say in, you know, creative choices, as you know, as opposed to like if you're, you know, Cameron doing Avatar, or you know, it's a $1 billion movie, then you get to dictate the creative choices. But if it's not, and you want to spend $200 million, then your creative choices are going to be scrutinized and countered by you know, various investment groups, depending on how much they're putting into the pot.
Right, right. I like that theory. I like imagining that Roland Emmerich set out to make a much simpler movie, literally just about the moon falling to Earth or getting whacked out of orbit and wrecking stuff. And all these investors and foreign entities forced him to add all the sci-fi nonsense into it. Do you think that's what happened?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it may well not be. I mean, I think more likely a lot of the blandness in kind of characterization to me feels like more of a corporate sheen of, you know, sanding the edges off a character who, you know, might be behaving in a certain way. It's like, well, you know, that might be a little too offensive, or that might be, you know, a little too over the top, and we think that's too silly or too goofy. You know, I think they should be taking it more seriously. So, you know, I think I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, a lot of those plot elements, the potpourri of sci-fi cliches that inhabits the hollow moon of Moonfall, I wouldn't be surprised if a good number of them were, you know, add-ons from studio/investor notes.
Yeah, just executives saying absentmindedly, but, you know what I like is those nanobots in that Keanu Reeves.
Can we get some nanobots in this thing?
Remake of Day the Earth Stood Still.
I think it's more likely that there's stuff like, you know, about that a lot of the notes were about character changes, which ultimately just sanded down all the characters into kind of very boring, one-dimensional, non-offensive, you know, puppets.
Yeah,
that felt pretty corporate to me. The just kind of how all the characters were pretty bland.
Yeah, that's. I don't know. It's weird. It's totally possible.
Think about it. Because there's no, like, you know, we go back to Independence Day. There's no, like, Randy Quaid kind of character. Like, even the even the group of conspiracy theorists that are in the 10 minutes of the movie and you never see him again, even them, all those who should be the fringe weirdos are all pretty boring and reasonable.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, they're not like, there's no Randy Quaid super weirdo, like, getting in the way and making a lot of noise.
Yeah, and the characters all...
There's nobody like that in the movie.
And the characters all have, like, these elements to them. Like, the son was in jail for drag racing or whatever.
Yeah, but then as soon as he gets out, like, the drag racing and he goes to jail. And it set up this whole kind of, potential, father-son story dynamic between Patrick Wilson and his son that is never explored in the movie. Like, when they finally get together, they have very minor disagreements and then just move on with the plot.
Well, and so much of it is just Patrick Wilson saying over and over again how much he loves his son.
Yeah.
And he'll do anything for his son.
Yeah, so, exactly. Where it's just like, well, yeah, we understand that, Patrick, because many of us have been exposed to fathers before, so we understand how that generally works. Parents most of the time love their children and will do anything for them. Yes, you don't have to keep monologuing about it.
Yeah, very good, Patrick. Yeah, that's the general rule.
Again, this is unfair to Patrick Wilson because, he is contractually obligated to recite those monologues.
Yeah, I mean, it could be corporate Sheen, and then the movie itself just feels so uninspired. So if poor Roland was saddled with all this bullshit, he was probably just at a certain point, going through the motions of making a movie because he was contractually obligated to. Maybe that's why.
Yeah, because it made me start. It made me think a lot about Pacific Rim 2. That was directed by Stephen DeKnight, and on his Twitter feed, a while back, he went through he actually responded to a lot of people that were, a lot of, Pacific Rim diehard fans that were like, why did you do this? How dare you change this? You've ruined my childhood, kind of stuff. With Pacific Rim, where I'm like, all right, but And I was, my general response to Pacific Rim 2 was I thought it was a pretty fun movie. I didn't have huge problems with it, but I guess I just wasn't like some people. I guess got super invested in fandom for Del Toro's Pacific Rim 1, which I thought was fun and fine too. But he went into In his feed, he went into a kind of a deep discussion and about the fact that Pacific Rim 2 was his first feature, his directorial debut as a feature director, because he's done lots of TV, and it was also like $100 million plus budget. So you're just like the director. If you're a first time director on $100 million plus budget, you are not in charge of the picture.
Right, right.
The studio will and does not, first off. So it's not like, I could have dictated any change whatsoever. And then he also talked a lot about how, when they were ready to go originally with the script, it was, Charlie Hunnam's character from the first one was the main character, of the sequel, and then Hunnam bailed on the project because his pet project got greenlit. So, and they, it wasn't a case of like, well, we'll just take some time. And it's like, no, you have to still shoot this movie. So they had to crazy rewrite the script to write out the main character and then still go do the movie. So there's all that. And then with all kind of studio stuff. So there's, there were just tons and tons of concessions that had to be navigated in order to even just make the movie. And so I'm curious about how much of that was kind of a similar story maybe on Moonfall, because it did feel like that there were this Moonfall just feels like a movie made up of concessions.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would say that it, Pacific Rim 2 did have, it got its problems, Scott Eastwood. but it's still kind of a fun monster movie. Like, it delivers the goods of a monster movie. What was so weird about Moonfall is while I was getting, you know, my weird disaster stuff with the gravity waves and whatnot every time the moon passed by, it just didn't have that sense of fun that, you know, as many concessions as there had to be made for Pacific Rim 2. I mean, maybe this just, there were even more concessions and it just drove the life out maybe. Of it. I don't know.
I mean, I think part of it is there weren't too many, like, you know, even when the moon was coming by, it didn't feel like they were set pieces. No. It just felt like the moon was coming by and a bunch of stuff got sucked up and then that was it. Like, it didn't feel like, you know, a set piece, like a, you know, Day After Tomorrow when you're seeing the air, you know, the different areas, you know, get taken out. It felt like it was just kind of a rinse and repeat. I think that was part of the problem as well, too. Because Pacific Rim 2, that's like you have different set pieces of the different kind of robot monster kaiju battles. So, you know, that, you know, so you had that, but like in like a Moonfall, it's just kind of like, oh, here comes the moon again. And it's, you know, we know what it's going to do. And it's, but yeah, it just, it didn't feel like that there was like, now this time around and we're in this area and it's going to do this crazy thing. It didn't feel like there was that kind of setup. It's just like, okay, well, we'll just let the computer suck up, you know, whatever's around here. And then,
and they were mostly, they were, you know, mostly on the road and in the mountains. There wasn't a lot of variety as far as environments. You're right. That got destroyed.
And yeah. And honestly, that could be a concession, because, like, you know, the complexity of having, you know, a kind of a more barren environment that you're tearing up versus, hey, we're, you know, downtown Chicago and the moon's going to come by and we're going to tear apart all of these buildings and have all of the stuff happening. I think that's a, you know, in terms of kind of complexity and maybe even, you know, just rendering time you need with computers, that might be a reason.
Right.
Where they were just like, we don't have the time or money to, you know, get on the street while the moon goes over a city. We got to do it out in the mountains.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. That could have been a concession, like a budgetary. You think in addition to, executive notes, they were probably not able to give him enough money to do all the things that he wanted to do.
It probably, or just they didn't want to, because they're, you know, it was just, I think it was just probably a case of like, yeah, like if your previous movie had been Independence Day, then you get the more money. But, it's the last couple of movies, you know, the returns, you know, weren't nearly as good. So, yeah, you're not going to get, you know, that extra, you know, $20 million you want for a set piece.
Right. I don't know. Then it just comes down to, why do it at all?
well, I mean, to a certain degree, you know, once the machine gets going,
yeah,
you know, it's not going to stop. So the choice can become, it ultimately comes down to, well, you can either do it and get paid, or someone else can do it and get paid.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's like, it's the, it's like the Lindelof interview where he's talking about Lost, and, you know, they're apparently the original idea for Lost story wise was just like a 3-season arc, and they were gonna, you know, that was gonna be it, and it was such a big hit that, you know, was it ABC didn't Lost,
yeah,
but the studio said, well, we want more, keep it going, and they're like, well, but the story, we were gonna wrap it up and season 3, and the studio's like, no, you're not, and you can either keep doing it or we'll just get someone else to keep doing it,
right?
And so it was like, well, you know, that's like the choices, do I keep doing it and keep getting paid for a hit show,
yeah,
so I'm gonna get paid well,
yeah,
or, you know, give it. So that's kind of, you know, that was kind of the story of Lost, and explained perfectly why, story-wise, the show went off the rails and event kind of sputtered out, because they had to keep spinning the plates when they were like, yeah, but we passed our exit for the really clean ending.
Right, right. Well, it'd be interesting to hear some behind the scenes confessions like that about this movie, for sure.
Yeah, I would be interested, because I was like, you know, I was looking forward to this, and I was hoping it was going to be, you know, big goofy fun return to, you know, original Independence Day.
We were so excited,
and you know, that's you know, I mean, the ultimate truth is like, when you're dealing with, you know, that much money on a movie, it's, yeah, I think, much, much easier for corporate interests to, you know, smooth it down to it being palatable for such a wide audience. It becomes really dull and really boring.
Yeah, I guess. And it's kind of sad. It's kind of a bummer. I wonder, you know, if I would have liked it more if I had just seen it on the TV in my living room.
Oh, if it was like a streaming service, like a Netflix produced.
Yeah. Because, I watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the new one, which came to Netflix with no fanfare this past weekend.
I don't think I would have liked it that much better, because I've seen some other stuff, like what was that Cloverfield space station movie.
Oh,
that Netflix did, and I was like, yeah, it was the same kind of like, well, you know, I still took my time to do this, but I just didn't have to, you know, drive to a theater and, you know, put on an N95 mask and then get told by the concession stand guy that, oh, we don't have, our hot dogs aren't ready, for some reason, at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon at a movie theater. They had a hot dog crisis.
Yeah, I
wanted a hot dog.
That was a bad sign. We should have known right away that we were in trouble when the hot dogs weren't available.
Yeah, and so it was like, do you want a hot dog or want a $15 pretzel? And I'm like, I don't want a $15 pretzel. I wanted a hot dog.
Yeah, I did too. I got a pepperoni.
And then I became like Charles Grodin and Lonely Guy.
I had a microwave pizza.
Yeah, I think I had one of those at that theater the last time we went there. And that rectangle pizza
box. Yeah.
Yeah, that like shoebox rectangle pizza is not particularly good.
No, it's really bad. Well, it's also microwaved. I mean, it was, and it's like that.
Yeah, it's like they don't even have like a little, like, you know, one of those like rapid pizza oven things. Like, and those have got to be easy to get because all of those like rapid pizza places have gone out of business. So there's got to be a lot of those ovens laying around.
Yeah, exactly. It was, it was disappointing. It was all around disappointing. But like I said, I was watching that Texas Chainsaw movie, which, you know, the critics hate. Everybody I talk to thinks it's awful. And I'm not saying it's a good movie, but I was entertained for the hour and 20 minutes because it was super gory, you know? So there was a level of inspiration, at least in the gags, which ultimately this is the upteenth sequel to a slasher movie. So you at least get delivered the slashings, you know, which is in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and for that type of movie, sometimes that's really all you need if you've got some inspiration there in the slashing department.
And that's what I'm saying about this movie. If the disaster sequences had been more inspired, you know, if the special effects at least had been inspired, then I probably would have liked it a lot more. But it's just wade through that dialogue, you know, because it, like, you know, you look at it like it's pornography, where it's a porn for disasters. So we're getting from disaster to disaster, really.
Right.
So if the dialogue and acting in between isn't that great, so be it. But if it goes on for
it's easier to forgive if the disaster sequences are the big roller coasters.
Right. Give me the good disaster. But this movie didn't have it. Unlike, you know, as bad as Texas Chainsaw Massacre might be, it at least delivers on ultimately one of the things that you go to see it with, one of its marketing promises that you're making just by saying, I'm making a slasher movie or I'm making a disaster movie. That's the first thing you got to deliver.
Well, I mean, this is definitely 45 minutes well spent talking about it.
I think for sure. Yeah. I mean, I got more out of this than I did out of the movie.
And the final spoiler is the moon does not fall.
No.
They convince the friendly AI to, I guess, drive it back into orbit, or I don't know what. I can't even remember what happened. But the moon went back, and it's a big moon spaceship.
Well, they had to blow up the nanobots first.
Yeah.
So once they blew up the nanobots, it could go back into space, I guess.
Right. Because, yeah. Oh, God. Sure. Yeah, okay. That was the... Because the... the nanobots were... were preventing the automatic shifter from being put into reverse.
It really was stupid. So that's our bacon episode about Moonfall. We'll see you in March, hopefully with a proper episode, assuming Stephen Falk's car is out of the shop.
Yeah, or it'll just be a follow-up discussion about Moonfall again.
Yeah, maybe this is what this show is from now on.
It's just from now on.
Just
Moonfall.
Just talking about Moonfall. Do one of those minute-by-minute podcasts, you know?
Yeah, well, let's break it down. That's the next podcast. We'll be like, we'll do a real in-depth breakdown of Moonfall.
Starting with all the... production company cards at the beginning. All right, well, we'll see you next time on the Film Pigs. On behalf of myself, Todd Anderson, and Steve Skelton, I say thank you. And of course, thank you, as always, to Adam Blau for the wonderful music.
Adam Blau.
Thank you, Adam Blau.